Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about Soil Test K and how that plays in with soil moisture. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at RCI's new bale accumulators. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of the pumpkin. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today is Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. It's been a real feast or famine year. We either get no rain or we get lots of rain.
All the rain.
All rain.
Rain.
And then
rain.
No rain.
Yes. It wasn't terrible. We got probably more than we needed in the period with which it came, but it wasn't super hard rains or anything like that. It was actually probably one of the nicer rain showers we've had.
Just I like that nice rain. Was it nice rain? Just that it lasts longer than like an inch an hour.
That is right.
The definition of a nice rain. Yeah,
I would agree.
4 inches in 20 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the not so nice rain.
There's one spot, I forget which evening. Still kind of warm out yet. We had the door open. The screen door was there. And all of a sudden I heard like just pounding on the pavement. And I'm like, what is going on? And it was just coming too fast for the eave troughs.
Oh, sure.
There was like one maybe 5 minute spot there. Otherwise, like you said, Todd, it was a nice soaker.
Yeah, I think we were here in the office for that one because all of a sudden it just like was hammering down and then it was over. I was like, oh, okay. I guess we're done now.
Those are the mean rains.
Yeah.
They're not so nice.
They're not so nice. Tell them to leave me alone.
But, I can't complain. It's improved soil test conditions for trying to stick a probe in the ground, which is always a benefit.
For harvest, it'll be interesting what it does, because in fertility.
Are we still harvesting?
There's enough corn out there.
Yeah, there is some corn out there.
Here and there.
It's winding down, which is good. I would consider our harvest season was very good.
Yeah.
So that was good. And
yeah, other than moisture is like tanking really fast for some guys. Like,
no, they tanked very fast for both beans and corn.
Beans and, yeah. The high moisture window was pretty narrow.
I was just going to say, yeah, you didn't have a high moisture window this year.
I had this field, I swear to God, went from 30. It was in the 30s. And I could look it up on my text messages because I text the person. But within 5 days, it dropped from like 35 to 20.
It didn't even
make sense like that it could physically do that.
You're not supposed to do that, corn.
No, it was like, holy man. And it was like half exciting, half like.
Oh so instead God. Of half a point a day, it was two.
It was running a, yeah, full point and a half for some of those days. And again, that was just one field. There was other fields where it was more like that full 1 point, which is in October doesn't.
No, but
doesn't
I
usually happen.
And the same thing, a guy's like, oh yeah, I tested it like a few days ago and it was like 26. And when I took a sample, it was like 19.
But I did just see, I think, a tweet last night from Sampy or one of the weather guys, like October was in the last 30 years was the warmest October.
So not the warmest ever, but the warmest in the last 30 years.
Luke Sampy's becoming my new favorite.
Yeah.
Weatherman, he's starting to beat out like some Philly D, some Phil DeCastro.
I'm not even on his beat.
Pete Petoniak's still a classic, but yeah.
You're not a big Cameron Moreland guy?
I am not.
I'm feeling the 3 degree guarantee.
I don't really care if he gets within 3 degrees, honestly. Just get the rain right. That would be, could he do that? Like a rain guarantee? Like if he doesn't.
I think there's a reason none of them.
Agreed. Yeah. I understand that. Yes, but
nobody's willing to put their neck on the line for how much rain, or if it's going to rain.
If I'm watching NBC weather, I want Michael Fish. So I just think that's the best.
Is he good at boat rain? Because he's a fish.
He must have know a little more.
He knows this moisture well.
No, but Luke Sampy's got to mean like he because he's on X and. He does other stuff.
And he's well-rounded, too. He's not just, here's one, he's talking about how to jump your car, like.
Okay.
With lightning?
No.
How does it tie into his job?
No, how to when you got a dead battery when your car, how to get another car to jump you. He's got some bucks in there.
Oh, so like how to get cars to breed.
Apparently some monkeys escaped from South Carolina. He's got that tweet in there.
Sweet.
So they're in the woods of South Carolina.
I do feel like my relationship with Weatherman this summer has been odd in that when it didn't, when it was raining all the time, it was like you're checking weather, multiple forecasts daily because it rained all the time and you wanted to kind of check when it was going to rain and you had to like do things around that. And then when it got dry in like August, September, October, I didn't look at the weather at all. I just assumed it wasn't going to, like even last year too, when it didn't rain forever, you just like, oh, I don't know.
I just assume it's not going to rain.
Yeah, I'm just going to assume it's not going to rain until somebody says, hey, there's a rain chance now coming.
Whereas I feel like I have no relationship with weathermen because I always just check apps and different
forecasts.
No, like I don't. Point.
The weather is faceless.
I don't go home and like watch channel whatever.
I do. Do you like channel weather? The 2-2, the
always some, weather?
Sometimes. Like, I will check that, and I actually got a couple farms that like to watch that one, and like, oh, so they'll tell me like, yeah, 2-2 said. But like, I feel like it's kind of difficult to really gauge rain amounts sometimes. Like it's either like lots of raindrops,
yeah,
or just like a sprinkling of raindrops. And it's not really,
I actually wish they'd have a cut in of the weather forecast
right
there more often.
Yeah, because yeah, they do have somebody that reads out like the,
sometimes
they got enough commercials.
Yeah.
He used to be always be Brad Spakowitz, but he's retired now, I think. So I don't know who even does the WBAY one. But
yeah, I wish they had somebody cut in. You know, that I'm sure they'd have to re-record it every 2 or 3 hours to make it somewhat accurate, but it would still be nice.
I'd actually prefer it to be Ollie Williams from Family Guy. It's going to rain!
Going to rain.
So I found it. Do you want to hear it?
Sure.
Okay, so he says this was posted 16 hours ago, so around the 7th of November. He said, as of yesterday, 2024 is ranking as the second warmest year on record in Green Bay. So second warmest on record in Green Bay. Of the top 20 warmest years on record, 9 of them have occurred in the past 20 years. So the top 20 warmest, the 9 of them have in the last 20 years. And of the top 30 warmest, 7 have occurred before 1950.
It's crazy how many records when you, like we, at the end of October, like around Halloween, there was the latest day to hit 80 in Green Bay.
Yep.
And it, a lot of those records were all from like 1915, like right ahead of, obviously ahead of the Dust Bowl, but I would have thought they would have been like in the Dust Bowl more.
Sure.
But a lot of them are kind of that.
Super dry.
Yeah. 1915 to the 20s. So it was interesting that, and I believe we did beat, it was like October 23rd. Was the record, and we bumped it back to like the 28th of October or whatever day it was that warm.
Yeah. Even, yeah, the day before Halloween was
like, was great.
70
yeah.
degrees out.
Yeah. Halloween.
Then Halloween was windy and cooler.
It okay, but not, which, not great.
It was,
but
to be honest, it was normal. I would say it was fairly close to what you would expect on Halloween. Yeah. It just felt colder because it had been so warm the day before.
Yeah.
So I could see, Todd, your 15 points if 2024 is ranking as the second warmest ever.
Especially October was extremely warm. Yeah, extremely warm.
Well, it makes a good segue into our topic because we're talking about when it's dry and how that affects soil test K levels. So, Bill, what do you got for us?
Yeah, obviously, if you've tried to do any tillage or soil sampling up until the last couple weeks, it's been a challenge. And I just wanted to kind of go over, like, will that affect your soil test levels? Like, do you have to take that into consideration maybe when you're looking at your soil test results when you get them back?
That's a good point. Look at the date of your soil test results.
Right.
Right.
If you have some questions. And if it was early, late summer, they're probably okay yet. But if it was kind of the early fall when it got really dry, you may have to take them with a grain of salt or think about why. And then later here, if you have fields that are out of whack or different, well, it's because we've been wetter, so it's going to sample differently too.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to say, yeah, I think anytime you're in one extreme or the other, I think we expect there to be some difference in the test. So even looking back, like if you look back and say last year's soil tests compared to this year's soil tests. Whenever it started raining last fall, you know, you're going to see differences even year to year, or like 3 years, I'm trying to think 3 to 4 years ago what the weather was like.
Well, 2019, 2018 was...
Right, so it was extremely wet.
Noah's Ark.
Yeah. Noah's Ark.
So...
Do you think, like, a lot of the universities will say, try to sample within the same, like, two-month window every time? So, say you sample in April, the next time you sample, you want to be kind of in...
And I was going to bring
March, April, May. Yeah, you know, you want to be kind of in that same window. Do you think that has to do with both the seasonality or just typically you're around the same moisture content at that time?
That for sure, moisture content, I would think for sure. Like, you know that if you're taking an April, not always. Last April, we weren't.
Yeah. No.
But most likely you are in the same moisture range. I wonder if temperature...
I know there's more than it's, and it's like residue breakdown.
Well, that
happens different. So it's more than just that. But that is one thing I hadn't thought about was moisture in that. I was just thought it was sort of other factors. But I think moisture is probably a pretty big factor that in general you're going to be a more similar moisture content. Not always,
don't be flip flopping, right? This time we're going to do it in in August or September or October, and then next time we're going to do it in March or April. Like, obviously there's scenarios that happens. Like,
right, sometimes you need to flip-flop, but then you got to understand why there could be a lot difference from that other sample to this one.
Yep.
What is hard with soil sampling is it's a snapshot on that day you took it, and you need to use that snapshot for 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
So that makes it really difficult that you want to have a good... accurate sample, but it doesn't always happen.
And then think about like 2019. By the time you get 3 years into using that sample, do you really remember 2019?
No, right.
You probably do, but you don't, right? You're not thinking about that when you're making your recommendation. So I think that's another thing to look at if you have multiple years of samples. Like, why is this one?
Look for outliers.
Outliers, right? Like, well... Yeah, it's an outlier because it hadn't rained for 6 months or whatever that number is.
That's one valuable part of soil testing that I see. It isn't the exact actual number all the time. It's what is that trend doing, and is this such an outlier that you could say, okay, yeah, it says this, but we know it might be a little different from that.
Well, and you know your, hopefully anyway, you know your fertility program, what you've been doing. So if you, if you see spikes when... that don't correlate to any changes you've made, like, oh, yeah, I've been fertilizing more, but my soil test went down, or, you know, things that don't necessarily make sense, but my yields went up, so maybe that does make sense. You know, there's other factors you can tie into it to kind of make sense of it.
What we've always used, and I like this analogy, like soil bank, and then in the bank, you know, I like to use the analogy of like a checkbook method too, where, like you said, Matt, you've got deposits that'd be fertilizer going in, and then you have withdrawals, which is
your yields
and crops. And so sometimes as you're trying to sort of balance that checkbook through whatever nutrient management software you use, there's times where it doesn't balance. And I'd consider like your soil test almost like, you know, telling you when you log into the bank, it's your bank statement.
Yeah.
You log in and you go like, oh man, I'm off. Which I don't know how many people balance a checkbook anymore. I do. I know Matt does.
Yeah. No, I do.
Bill, do you balance a checkbook?
No, I don't. I've gotten lazy over the years.
I do it on my computer. Like, I don't actually keep the check log anymore, but I
still have a ledger.
I have a ledger in my computer.
So is it just a spreadsheet, or do you have like a program?
Yeah, no, it's a spreadsheet with formulas and stuff that basically it does the math for me.
Right.
So it's easier than me having to sit there and like, okay, carry the one. Nope.
Did I transpose these numbers, 76?
Ooh, is that 67? A 3 or an 8? Crap, my handwriting sucked.
Most people just make sure it's above 0.
right.
No, that's the only reason I still keep a ledger. It's like, okay, there's money in there.
Yeah, we still have money. Yeah.
There's money there. You guys have carbon copy checks?
I do.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm still like the old school. Again, because I write them down anyway, I guess. So I don't use the carbon copy.
But you have the ledger on the other side of your checkbook.
Yeah. I didn't even know you could order checks without the little carbon thing.
Yes. You can, yeah.
Because I just order whatever I ordered last time. Like I,
sure.
I don't change my checks. I don't have cartoon characters or anything fun in my checks because I don't write enough checks.
You don't want personalized
checks, Well, they're personalized. They have my name on them. Well, okay.
But yes,
I don't pay the extra money to have, cartoon. Because I don't write enough checks. Like, that was the thing. I remember when we were younger, it was like, oh, because I'm going to give these people.
It was definitely in the 90s.
Might laugh or, you know, get a kick out of it. Or
I wanted to express my personality through my checks.
Credit cards, too. Remember, like, when I got my first credit card, you could, like, pick the face of it or whatever. Now they're all just kind of standard.
You don't want Packers checking?
No, I don't. I don't need to pay an extra, like, $5 to have a little G on my check.
They're just generic blue or green.
Yeah, they're like a light blue with some kind of
a heather
bar or whatever. Yeah, and all the it's like I don't even know. I can't even accurately describe a check for you. Checks, for those of you who might be younger listening, are a piece of paper with which you write an amount of money, and they're equal to cash, but other places won't take them anymore.
Right.
My favorite experience was the first time I went to a gas station, paid with a check. They like ran it through a thing where it printed like void on it and then handed me the check back.
Like Walmart.
This is pointless. Like, why did I even do this? But
it's like a piece of paper that says, I don't have any money, but these people here.
Yeah. I have the money. I don't have it with me.
Yes.
I'm not carrying
said
money.
It's in this institution right here.
Right.
And here's the numbers that we'll draw from.
Right.
And then you got the check card, which is now we just call them debit cards. But first they were kind of like your check card. Like instead of writing a check, you just hand them this card. So it was this whole evolution of
crazy. Matt and I just went through an experience that the bank we bank at no longer use the routing number.
Oh yeah,
like banks got bought out, and it was still this old routing number, and then they're like, hey, you got some time to change it. Or at first,
it was a long time.
It was like a year.
That they kept
but it was still like, I had a bazillion D checks, so it was like, I'm just writing out checks.
Bazillion D?
Yeah.
And that's
it was a new number.
It was exactly 1,000 checks, I think I had to throw
Kevin Jerk is listening, a bazillion D. And that's a new number.
That's why I only buy like one thing of checks at a time, because I don't go through them very fast. And then I don't stock up on them. Because I had that same...
Checks are weird. When you run out, it stinks, though, because then you're just like,
I had that same experience when I lived in an apartment, then we moved into our house.
Oh, the address.
Like, I had a bunch left over, and it's the wrong address. And that used to be... Like, now I don't think anybody actually gives a
flying nobody cares. Yeah.
Whatever. But, yeah, it was like, you're going to cross it out, put your new address, or have your driver's license, and they'd check it or whatever, and it was just dumb. So...
Do you sign your credit cards?
No. I do not.
I do not either.
Aren't you supposed to or not?
Nobody checks it anymore. Even the post office. The post office was like the last bastion of like they'd look at.
Oh my God, that one lady in the post office was.
Yeah.
Nobody
looks at it anymore because it's all you. Like you put it in the machine and you take it out. Especially when they went to chips, that seemed to really.
Yeah, this new one doesn't even have a spot to do it.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't even think of that.
To me, they're supposed like don't sign it. Then they're supposed to look for an ID if you don't sign it.
Or some people would write check ID.
Yeah.
In that thing. But
for fraud.
That was a fraud thing. But you're right. Now that I think about it, most of the credit cards don't even have a spot for you to sign anymore.
How did we get on this banking talk?
We're banking soil.
So the soil test, like you said, is like your statement, and so. What's hard is there could be like you either did the math wrong or the bank did the math wrong at times, and this is what we're trying to sort of calibrate back. That say that number comes back,
or Mother Nature could have done that,
right?
Because when like
it just
the next point would be is like when you took samples this fall, I think could affect things because we are getting soil test K from our crop residue, and it takes water to do that. To release it back to the soil. So if you took it early, you had dry soil, which is going to screw with your soil test, and you didn't have that residue breakdown yet. So
we learned that the hard way last year because even at the beginning of the season, like we saw all summer when it was dry last year, like residue not moving in the soil. So the biological activity is not there in the soil to kind of help with that stuff. So water is very important.
it was actually surprising. I found a study out of Purdue. It actually takes more water than I expected to do that. And it showed that the study showed that in soybeans, there was only 12% remaining, but it took like 20 inches of rain. So
20 inches?
Yeah.
That's a lot of rain.
Yeah. That's,
so it does take quite a bit, but again,
it's like it's, half of what we get in a year.
Right. So we do lose a lot, but it does take time. The average is 5 to 10 inches.
Okay, to get so normal you'd want, which is still quite a lot as well, actually.
And in corn, we remove about 50% in the same amount. So it actually does take a little more. It's corn is slower than soybeans to release its K. So I thought that was interesting too. So kind of think through that when you're, okay, I took the soil test in September. Yep, the corn was off early, but it didn't rain till the end of October. It was really dry. We may have some issues there to manage and watch through. And maybe if you get a really weird number, you want to retake it now once it has rained here. Just, you know, maybe find those points or find a certain field that you don't like.
I've thought of that on a retake. Do you need to take, you know, like say now in school they let you retake tests all the time and that, but they aren't going to make you, they make you retake the whole thing. You just got to redo the ones you got wrong in general, I believe.
I'm amazed at that.
Yeah.
How much
it's
like, even my kids, like
that's a debate among
your homework. You can redo it. Tests.
I can see it though. Do you want them to actually learn the content?
Yeah.
Or do you want them to,
yeah,
like the point, I think the point of it is you, so they actually learn the material it, rather, yeah, than, oh, we're just going to move on. So you didn't know it. Now you're going to get dumber as you go because you failed to learn it the first time, and we don't want you to learn it at all.
But there's a line to where you got to, you still got to know it at the time. Like, I also see it though in some students that then they're like, oh, I don't care.
Right. To be
I'm not
going to
study,
right,
because I'll just retake it. And that, if it hits that line, then you went too far with it. You know that.
Right.
That,
no,
well, there's,
I would agree. Yeah.
There's no consequence that I wasn't prepared on the day of the test, so I'll just wait and redo it and stuff. So,
life is the consequence.
We are tangenting today.
The retake, I don't think you got to retake every point is where I was going with that.
Right.
So,
no. Well, I think even if you had a point of comparison, you
correct,
know, it went
exactly
from this to that.
That's, yeah, what I'm saying is I think you say there's 10 points in the field, maybe you retake a couple of them, and then you see how much difference they were. That's what I was getting. And
yeah,
okay, yeah, they're close to the same, or no, these are both way off, or maybe they're way off in a different thing. Then you may get to retake more points. But this isn't like a redo the whole thing. And I don't think I would retake. Part of me wanted to say we'd retake a composite. So what a composite is where you kind of do like a whole 40 acres or a whole field and kind of group a bunch of those together instead of doing an area, like a more small area. But if you did that, I don't know that you'd see the difference rather than actually retaking some of your zones or points. I think you'd actually, it'd be better because then you'd see, okay, in this pointer zone, it changed by this much. Be a little more exact. But
and soil type's probably an issue too, right?
Yeah, just for sure. Soil type would be
heavier clays, going to bind that a little tighter than maybe a sandwood. So if you've got that soil that's a little more clay content, this is probably going to be a bigger issue. So you've got the fact that the dry weather reduces that availability in the soil of the K, and then no rain hasn't leached out that K out of the residue yet. So you got kind of a double whammy there to take into consideration. The interesting part to wrap up is K availability will be overestimated in a low testing soil. If soil is dry, when you take it to the lab, K will be overestimated in a low testing soil. So if you, I'm just going to throw a number out there, what you can debate what low is, but let's just say it's comes back at 100. Maybe it's really only 80 because it's the test is overestimating. And conversely, it's going to underestimate in high testing. So if you know that it's a high testing point, maybe it was in a pasture or something, and it was 200, 250, maybe it's really 300 or 350. So that's something to take into consideration too. If you know this field is a historically low testing field, your soil test may show better than what the field really is.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. We were having a debate before the recording here of how, like, low is overestimated and high is underestimated doesn't initially make sense as far as, like, you'd think it'd be always low or always high, not, like, wouldn't matter the total soil test content. But, and I don't know that we came up with a good answer of why it is, but I imagine it has to do with, like, we've been talking moisture, like, the availability of the K in the soil, its ability to move through the soil, which K isn't the most mobile of the nutrients, but there's still obviously changes in it over time. So yeah, I don't know that we have a good reason why it is, and it's interesting that it is a kind of a diverse difference, and I wonder where that line is. Like, is it, yeah, 100, 150? Like, where's the line where it starts overestimating versus underestimating? And I don't know, but it's just kind of interesting to think about.
My brain still isn't wrapped around that.
Yeah, no, it's...
But if that's what the research shows, that's what it shows, and that's an interesting concept to think about. So that you really do got to watch that number, that you could actually be potentially slightly overestimating or underestimating both. What is almost good with that is that I don't, and again, if it's a swing of, it says plus or minus 15%, yes, that's a big deal. It could be, however, that's still not the end of the, like, an 80 to 100, we're going to change our racks and it's going to be different. But it's not like some sort of huge change that it's not worth taking the test or not, you know, worth right. what you're going to get. Like,
and if it's high and higher, you're not going to put more fertilizer out anyway.
Right.
And you're probably not going to cut back anymore. Like, the
correct.
Difference from a 200 actually, to a 250 or a 300,
isn't going to matter.
Right.
And then on the low side, on a year like this where margins are tight,
fertilizer hasn't come down.
Right. It might be better anyway. It might make you feel better about right. cutting back anyway, which is good. I'd rather you feel better about it and be okay than sort of worry that, oh my God, we're shorting something, but it really doesn't matter. So yeah, I that's still more accurate than no test or trying to guess at stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's hard because for a company like us, we can't, it's going to rain 4 inches around Halloween. Well, wait till soil sample till after Halloween. Like that's just not realistic in most business structures. So to do the same thing on a farm, like if you're sampling your own, you don't know what the weather's going to be a month from now. So pull a sample when you can and manage around it, right?
Yeah, and I would even say we've been able to sample much quicker, even that as harvest is, a lot of times we're behind that, so that if the farm wants to do tillage or wants to do something, they can go do it, and we're not sort of the holdup to that whole process. And I think that part of it bodes well in that then if every year you're doing it sort of a... If you wait too long after harvest and then more of that residue breaks down, your sample results are going to be quite different. So that staying consistent with that, yeah, we're you know, you harvested and we're fairly close after all the time. I think that is bodes better for it. And again, like we talked, that's why we take samples every 3 to 4 years to see this change that we can't explain at times and to maybe get, you know, good results as much as we can. So
I think that even, you know, considering the residue breakdown, I don't know that everyone does. And in fall samples, you're probably not going to have much residue breakdown anyway. From, like, if I harvest my corn in October and I sampled a week or two later, there's still a lot of residue there. Versus right. in the spring, you're consistently probably going to have more residue breakdown over the course of the winter, spring time frame than you do with the fall.
And
stuff.
If we're following the combine, there's going to be no leaching or breakdown of nutrients because we're right there.
Right. So with fall samples, it's probably always going to end up being a little higher than what we actually see just because of that. So anyway, there you go. There's some things to consider when looking at your K levels because of dry soil conditions. And now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So RCI is taking bale accumulators to the next level. Wisconsin company's improvement to John Deere's round baler allows operators more control over where bales are released. So in the summer of 2023, Randy and Wendy Clark, owners of RCI Engineering in Mayville, Wisconsin, were asked by John Deere to take over production and improve Deere's bale accumulator for use on its round balers. Bale accumulators are designed to pull behind a round baler to collect two or three round bales and group them around a field, reducing the number of stops and trips across the field to pick up bales. So Randy is a mechanical engineer by trade, according to his wife, Wendy. We have been an allied John Deere supplier for 19 years. In 2019, the husband-wife team also became the owners of Ag Bag. So John Deere has sold bale accumulators since 2017. Based on customer and dealer feedback, the company learned that farmers like the bale accumulator, but they don't want to slow down their harvesting process, so improvements were needed to make the unit more efficient. The Clarks developed a prototype of the bale accumulator in 2023 and started testing it. The redesigned 52-1R and 42-1R bale accumulators were introduced in September. So according to Randy, this is the next generation of the product and is available through any John Deere dealer. They added hydraulic cylinders to the transfer arm so that the operator has more control over the speed and placement of when the bales are released. Also, the operator can choose where to position bales. The new models are faster and more efficient and can carry up to two bales and place them with a third. There is a manual control or automatic control option. So there you go. Pretty cool that they were able to take a product and make it more efficient. I kind of like the picture they have here where they're basically just dropping them all in the headlands.
That is awesome.
They go, yeah.
Like it's just, yeah, all around bales.
You just drive around the perimeter of the field and pick up. Yeah.
Which think of how, from an agronomist standpoint.
Compaction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of other savings of time and fuel to go chase bales, but just compaction, that if you could stay along the headlands and only have to pick up bales and play, because that's the other part, you're not going out picking a bale and bringing it back. Usually you're following with the, you know, whatever truck or tractor,
yeah, tractor system,
you know,
whatever
you have, whatever you have kind of putting bales on. And yeah, if you could just go up the headlands where you're already, you know, usually I have compacted soils anyway, that'd be great.
That picture looks like a soybean field that they were baling.
Oh,
soybeans.
You're right.
Yeah. Yep. Baling soybeans.
But even a hay field, if you had like two or three lines within a field, because you're probably going to get more bales.
Right.
Not just the headlands, but at least, you know, even more controlled traffic would be nice.
Yeah. Maybe that's the next step for RCI, is to figure out how to
GIS dropping,
how to turn it so it like drops it in the row. Because I could see, just looking at the, I'll be honest, I've never run a bale accumulator for a round baler, or really even watched one probably that I can think of. But yeah, just the positioning of them, like if you could put them in a line versus where you could just follow the rows to where the tractor had already driven versus.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's cool either way. Good to know they've made improvements, and hopefully will help out the growers that use it. So now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So today we're talking the pumpkin. We just had Halloween, but Thanksgiving's coming up, and that's when we eat a lot of pumpkin pie. So few horticultural crops signal the arrival of autumn more than the pumpkin. This fall, millions of Americans will eat an annual pilgrimage, or make an annual pilgrimage to a retail outlet to purchase the vegetable they unfortunately are very unlikely to eat. While many people throughout the world use pumpkin as a staple in their daily diet, the United States, the colorful member of the gourd family, is used primarily for decoration. Halloween and Thanksgiving just would not be complete without pumpkins to add a festive air to the observation of these events. October is the appropriate month to take a closer look at this fall favorite. Pumpkin derived its name from the Greek word pepin, which literally interpreted means large melon. The French word for pepin was pompon, and the English changed the latter to pumpion. American colonists were credited with changing pumpion to pumpkin, the name which is still associated with this vegetable. Pumpkin is somewhat of a generic name assigned to several members of the genus Cucurbita. They include C. maxima, C. moschata, and C. pepo. The names pumpkin and winter squash commonly are used for all of these species. However, most authorities place the large orange fruit sold for autumn decoration in the species C. maxima and assign winter squash as the common name to the other two. Interestingly, the canned product sold for making pumpkin pies is actually a species of winter squash.
So we're having winter squash pie?
Winter squash pie, yep. So while pumpkins have been around for a long time, colonists are thought to have first prepared the early pumpkin pie by slicing off their tops, removing the seeds, and refilling the inside with a mixture of milk, spices, and honey. The resulting concoction was baked in hot ashes and is said to be the origin of pumpkin pie. Columbus was known to have taken pumpkin seeds back to Europe on one of his excursions. However, pumpkins were a warm season vegetable that required a relatively long growing season. Thus, they've never really gained popularity in Northern Europe and the British Isles, where the summer temperatures are not conducive for their growth.
Did not know that.
So that's why you probably won't get much pumpkin pie over there.
Is it really pumpkin pie, though?
Winter squash pie.
Winter squash. Have we been lied to?
Well, they're all gourds of some kind, so I mean...
Yes.
I guess it depends how picky you really want to be.
Do you guys bake up your pumpkin seeds?
Oh, yeah.
No? Sometimes.
Okay. That's a lot of work, by the way.
It's a lot of work. Like, which part?
Cleaning?
Yeah, you got to, like, wash them.
Yeah, you don't just leave them in the pumpkin guts and bake
them. No, but I don't know.
Should.
I just never really acquired that much of a taste for them, so.
A little bit of Lowry's salt. And
is that what you use? Lowry's?
Tried some Old Bay on them.
Yeah, if you put enough stuff on anything, it'll taste good.
Oh, yeah. No. I wouldn't say a ton of Lowry's salt, but enough. Yeah, you got to salt them somehow. You can't just.
Air fryer works good.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
With salt? Like, what kind of?
I did paprika and some other pepper and salt.
Yeah.
But the trouble with the air fryers, if you let them go too long, they start popping like popcorn.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Is that good, though? Are they good?
Have you tried? Yeah, they popped. Did you eat any of them?
I did. It's kind of anticlimactic because that crunch is what I like about pumpkin seeds.
Now, I prefer the pumpkin or the winter squash pie to the seeds.
Yeah, pumpkin pie is awesome.
All right.
Thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone or on your Android phone. You need to download an app like Podcast Addict, and there you can also search Tilth Talk Radio, and you'll find us. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthegg.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week, Mary Schreiber of Wisconsin was elected to the 2024-2025 National FFA Officer Team. So as the 95th Wisconsin FFA Convention rolled to a close in June, President Mary Schreiber was prepared to take off her blue corduroy jacket for the last time. But that blue jacket didn't hang up for long. Former East Troy FFA chapter member was elected to the slate of 37 candidates to the elite team of six during the final session of the 97th National FFA Convention and Expo in Indianapolis. This year's team is comprised of Thaddeus Bergschneider of Illinois, who was elected national president, Luke Jennings of Ohio, elected national secretary, Caroline Groth of Kentucky was elected Eastern Region Vice President. Abigail Jacobson of California was elected Western Region Vice President. And Jack Ligenfelter of Georgia was elected Southern Region Vice President. And Schreiber of Wisconsin was elected to the Central Region Vice President. So according to Schreiber, simply put, this organization and the incredible people within it have changed my life for the better. At each chapter visit, banquet, conference, chapter event, and every moment in between, I was reminded of the incredible impact this organization has had on every life it touches. So Wisconsin FFA members that have been members of the National FFA Officer Team are Owen Owens from 35 to 36. He was a vice president. Ivan Kainshi from 39 to 40 was president. William Bame was secretary from 67 to 68. Garrett DeBruce, 74 to 75, vice president. Kara Doyle, from 1982 to 83, was a vice president. Jackie Munt, 2004 to 5, was president. Alicia Hodnick, 2011 to 12, was a vice president. Courtney Zimmerman, 2021 to 2022, vice president. And Mary Schreiber, 2024 to 2025, is now a vice president. So very cool for her.
It's a pretty short list, actually, like a pretty exclusive group.
Yeah,
there.
You get about 10
names. You'd think for how big, you know, Wisconsin is in general the most membership, I think, that attends the national convention. Texas is probably maybe more, I don't know. But has quite a few that to be, you know, not, it's not like every couple of years even there's a member. It's every 10 or so.
Yeah, the last one was 21 and 22, so a little bit of gap there. But prior to that, it was 2011 to 2012, so. Yeah, good for her, and keep up the good work. All right, that's corny this week. Harvest prices for crop insurance have plunged. So what does that mean for producers? Well, I think we all know where commodity prices have been at, and the Risk Management Agency has just released official harvest prices for federal crop insurance, and they came in well below the base prices set back in February. So harvest price for corn, $4.16, soybeans, $10.03, confection sunflowers, $27.30, and oil sunflowers, $22.60. So that's a 50-cent drop from the base price in corn, a $1.52 drop in the base price from soybeans, and a $1.50 and $1.20, respectively, for sunflowers. So harvest price is based on the average price during October. This year, those numbers were well below 2023. And the base price, as was mentioned there. So the drop comes as no surprise to Tony Jacina, the Senior Vice President of Insurance, Farm Credit Services America. We've seen the trend in play for a while. Not the tray and blend. But in October, we did get a bit of a bump. Could have been worse. It's still bad enough when you think about the price of bean corn down 11% from spring and beans roughly 13%. Trend has not been our friend, that's for sure. Lower harvest price levels will trigger some insurance payouts for the 2024 crop, according to Randy Martinson of Martinson Ag Risk Management in Fargo, North Dakota. So there's likely going to be revenue losses in some areas on soybeans, corn. It's just going to depend on if you had rain or drowned out corn earlier in the season, he said. With these prices, margins will be even tighter in 2025 and for some maybe in the red. So, yay.
Boo.
Boo. Definitely boo. All right. Now we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. We were just talking about pumpkins. Well, an over 2,500-pound Wisconsin pumpkin has broken the previous state record. So that's a ton and a quarter, or over a ton and a quarter. The Atlantic Giant was grown by Jim Ford and weighs 2,551 pounds. The plump pumpkin earned a Wisconsin state record and also earned a site record at the 2024 River Prairie Ginormous Pumpkin Festival. Love that name. In the city of Altoona, Wisconsin. So in second place was a 2,419-pound pumpkin.
You got to feel pretty good about yourself. I got a 2,400-pound pumpkin. Right, I don't win this sucker. Yep. And then you show up and you're 100 and
well, yeah, the top
40 pounds.
Top three were all, yeah, over 2,000 pounds. So Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers tracks the state's biggest pumpkins. It's been doing that since 1983, when the largest pumpkin only weighed a fraction of the 2024 winner, a mere 271 pounds. Can you imagine that? Having, yeah, in 1983, be like, ooh, 271, yeah, this is going to be great. Nobody will beat this for a long time. And then, yeah. Never mind. 40 years later, we've got a 2,551 pounder. That would make a lot of pumpkin pie if we actually used pumpkin for pie. But yeah, that is, it's definitely a rather large pumpkin.
What do they do with those giant pumpkins? Like,
let them rot.
Yeah, throw them in a field.
I don't know that there's really anything you can do.
You need a chainsaw to cut them up?
Bust them up for the deer. Yeah. Drop them from a great height and see how much damage it does.
They are cool. Like one of my wife's uncles used to grow, and he's got the 2009 record of 1,569 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And they used to have like a pumpkin patch up in Howard, and then he'd grow the big ones. And yeah, a lot of times, you like you say, like it's pretty anticlimactic that way. What you do, you can't carve them that easily because they're so big.
How
and like,
thick is the...
Yeah, get, the rind's like, thick.
Just and, get a pressure washer and start blasting yeah, away at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they... I can't see any comment. They got some pictures from the festival, and they have this giant hat.
The hat makes me laugh.
And I've like, is that just something they have for the winter? I wonder.
Like, it's like Elmer Fudd.
Did you see like the belt that he gets for the winter?
Yeah, I did see the. I like the belt. Yeah,
it's like a pumpkin with a bird
championship belt. Yeah. Well, if you look at the banner, that must be their logo for the festival.
Okay.
There's like a red-winged blackbird on
the pumpkin. Oh, yeah, I see it now. Okay, it was just darker.
Yeah. So that must be, I don't know what the red-winged blackbird represents, or at least that's what it looks like as far as a bird. But
yeah, it's not a blackbird.
And then he gets, must be a special chair to sit in because there's like an orange chair. It must be Pumpkin Master because next to it is a green Squash Master chair. So...
Got like a pumpkin tie.
Is he like the official mayor of the town then for the next year because he has the giant pumpkin? Or is there a pumpkin ambassador?
Did
they send him other places?
Did it tell any of his tricks on how to grow the pumpkin?
Hang on, I'm in the wrong spot here. I don't think they gave away any secrets.
He would not want to do that.
That's always the thing with the growing the large pumpkins too is like if you miss that window to put it on like a pallet or something, like if you're not prepared for
no most time they're on the pallet right away. But you gotta pick like the right one and you gotta
I mean in the backyard if I was trying to do this, I wouldn't anticipate that I was going to do this well, especially the first time around.
Right.
But yeah, if you got surprised and you're like, oh this thing's getting heavy, like
this is great. On the Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers.com statistics, they got world champions as well.
Okay.
And Tuscany, Italy had one, and it was 2,700 pounds.
Wow.
So, like, that's huge.
There was, and I didn't look this year or didn't notice this year, but there was a guy on Main Street that would have put out his, like, big pumpkin out in the front yard here in Seymour. And I don't remember seeing one this year, so I don't know if he didn't grow one or if what happened there. But it really barely even looks like a pumpkin anymore when they're that big, too.
One of the cool parts about this guy's winning one is it's really nice and orange yet and still has the pumpkin look to it.
Right.
That is cool because some of those I've seen where they don't even get really orange. And then any, like, the veins on the side.
Yeah, they're so more plump. Like a white or yellowish color. There is... In the background, and I don't know if it's the runner-up of the picture they have at the top of this article, one that looks more pumpkin-y, like has the rounded, like a dome kind of behind the stage. And then I'm assuming those are the gourds, like they look like giant green pumpkins in the background. But yeah, you can't even like set it up anymore. Like it's on this, once it's on the pallet, it's kind of like there. But very cool for him. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about soil test K levels and how moisture content can affect that. In our spotlight, we took a look at RCI's modifications to John Deere bale accumulators. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of the pumpkin. Cool beans this week is Mary Schreiber elected to the National FFA Officer Team from East Troy, Wisconsin. That's corny. Harvest prices caused crop insurance price differences. And our Field Good Friday 2,500-pound-plus pumpkin wins and breaks the previous state record in the ginormous pumpkin contest. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.